WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Had President Obama not been reelected, today's program might have been about the dismantling of his first term's signature legislative achievement, the Affordable Care Act. But the president is about to serve a second term, and hopes foes may have had for the act's demise seem to have been thwarted. Still, the politics of implementing this program remain, and some states are weighing lawsuits against the federal government over the act while continuing to debate how to implement the law in their respective states. North Carolina's new Republican Governor Pat McCrory and our Republican legislature will also have to grapple with this in the days to come. So this hour, we're going to look at the act, at why states are continuing to argue over this law, at what decisions states must make to implement it, and more. We're joined by Thomas Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and senior health economist for the Joint Economic Committee. He's also co-author of Why Obamacare is Wrong for America, and heads the American Enterprise Institute's Beyond Repeal and Replace Health Reform Project. He joins us from Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Dr. William Brandon is in our studio here in Charlotte. He is the Metrolina Medical Foundation Distinguished Professor of Public Policy on Health at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being back with us again.
Good morning.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Brandon. I know that the Affordable Care Act is scheduled to roll out in stages. Can you give us a quick overview of what the act will bring to Americans in terms of changes in how they receive and pay for health care, and in terms of what those who currently have no insurance may have access to that they wouldn't have had in the absence of the law?
Sure. The goal of this act is to ensure many more people are insured now. It won't be universal. We won't get to that, but it expands coverage so people have financial access to health care. In addition to that, an aim of this, a hope, is to make sure that health care costs do not rise faster than they would in the absence of this act. There'll be four sources of coverage. One, Medicare will continue the way it's been. The official line while the struggle to pass the Affordable Care Act occurred was that it would be unchanged. There are improvements for elders in it, but there's relatively little. The official line is it will not expand. Most of us will still get our health care from our employers if we're employed. And there are changes in that legislation. For example, coverage of young people up to 26 if they don't have on their family coverage of their parents if they don't have other sources of insurance. The innovative aspect of this is the development of the exchanges, which I'm sure we'll talk about a lot today, mm-hmm. and one of the issues facing North Carolina. And these are new markets. Imagine Expedia.com, some of the travel, the way we buy airplane tickets now, as a way of selling health care insurance.
So these are aggregators?
Aggregators, yeah.
Okay.
And the fourth source of insurance is Medicaid, our program for low-income people. This is being greatly expanded as a result of the Supreme Court decision. States will have a decision to make whether or not to expand their Medicaid so it covers every legal person living in the United States legally up to 138% of poverty. The one thing that makes this work, the whole prospect, particularly in the exchanges, is that there's a mandate that Americans should seek coverage, should get coverage. And there is a penalty. The Supreme Court called it a tax, which will enforce and nudge us along to get that insurance. And that's necessary in order to make the exchanges work.
So, Mr. Miller, do you agree with that, or would you just like to answer the question I just asked him in your own way?
Well, there's often a big gap between the theory or the sales marketing of the Affordable Care Act and its reality. Let's take it in some highlights of some pieces. What the act is about is a lot more regulation, federal regulation of what has largely been a state-regulated area of health insurance, but that regulation will permeate through a lot of health care practice as well. We've got a lot of subsidies, income-based subsidies, which stretch as high as 400% of the federal poverty level, which is pretty generous. Basically, you won't really know what the price or the cost of health care is because the subsidies, to the extent that you had any pricing, will pretty much submerge that, both on premium subsidies and cost-sharing subsidies. There's a lot of skepticism as to whether the projections as to whether this act will pay for itself will work out that way in practice. For example, Medicare was changed quite a bit in the sense that there is a projected scheme of continuing year after year to reduce reimbursement to Medicare providers. That's what financed a good bit of this act. Whether that's sustainable over a longer period of time remains in doubt. Ultimately, you'd have Medicare reimbursements if you followed these formulas with year after year adjustments, eventually descending down to the level of Medicaid reimbursements, which we know are inadequate at this time. There's a massive expansion in Medicaid. After the Supreme Court decision, of course, a number of states are holding out on that. They have an unlimited amount of time to decide whether they want to agree to that expansion. But that significantly expands a entitlement program which is already troubled, doesn't have the funding to actually do a good job at serving its current population, and that would expand the base up to really 138% of the federal poverty level. It's going to be very complicated administration. A lot of things were imagined in theory. They're a little harder to bring about in practice. What we've seen thus far in the Affordable Care Act in the early years were the easy early deliverables which were attractive. Going into 2014, particularly with the exchanges, where they can be fielded and implemented, all of the cross-wiring of information for eligibility and subsidies remains to be seen whether that can work out that way. Costs will be higher. I know what's projected, but there's somewhat automatic assumptions as to how these costs will work out. The reality is, particularly next year with the exchanges in parts of the individual market and the small group market, we're going to have some very substantial premium spikes because of the rules that were set in place for how this new insurance is supposed to operate. All of that cost-reducing potential of the act hasn't materialized thus far and remains in doubt that it's going to happen. So we're going to have a bit of a mess, and the exchanges are another part of that mess, where a number of states, probably at least 20, maybe more, are saying, you take care of it, feds. We don't want our hands on this one. Now, some of this is a continuation of old political arguments, but it also reflects some serious concerns about whether these exchanges can actually operate. And then there's kind of this intermediate zone, which North Carolina is one of the states considering that, to do what's called a partnership exchange, where it's mostly really a federal exchange, but it has a little bit of state involvement in it.
Now, that is fine. I want to come back to that, because that's something that Beverly Perdue, the former governor, arranged for with the government. Now we have a new Republican governor. I want to find out later on in the program if that might be overturned or changed in some way. But let me go back to something that Thomas Miller just said, and that is that we won't know what things cost under this plan. We don't know what things cost today, do we? I mean, I've asked doctors what procedures cost. They have no idea. Not a clue. Couldn't tell you.
It's because we live in a world where there's so much cross-subsidy going on anyway. So one of the things the Affordable Care Act does is it does perpetuate it. I agree with Mr. Miller that it is a very complex bill. Essentially, this Obama adopted an idea that was developed by the Heritage Foundation. So it's really a conservative idea that was launched in the 1990s. It's a voucher bill. Vouchers have always been a favorite of conservative people who didn't want the federal government to be involved directly in administering programs. So there are subsidies for the purchase of insurance from private commercial firms. And this really is a piece with using food stamps, which were acceptable idea on the right, and school vouchers, which of course is something that conservatives often push for. Mm-hmm. The result is complexity, and these things have to be regulated if you're going to go down this route.
I think it was you, Dr. Brandon, who at the beginning of the show said that most people will continue to get their insurance, if they already have insurance, from their employers. Did you say that?
I did.
And I'm curious curious about that because some conservatives argue, and maybe rightfully so from what I understand, what I've read in the press, that that will not be the case because businesses, particularly small businesses, will just say, well, we got these exchanges. Go buy your own insurance. I'm not going to supply it anymore.
That's quite possible, but there are incentives to for small businesses with under 25 employers to actually go and buy employment-based insurance, and it's made easier for them.
But if premiums go up, wouldn't it be cheaper to pay the fine in some cases than to pay the premiums?
It might be, particularly for larger businesses. But you can, if you can have 35% of your wage costs, you can attract workers this way.
So Thomas Miller, if that were to happen, would that be better for workers to buy their own insurance because their employers have said, forget it, I'm not doing this anymore, go do it yourself?
Well, I can imagine another world where that might work out okay, but we have to deal with the actual rules and practices of the Affordable Care Act and its limitations. There's a lot of speculation as to which employers would drop their coverage. Keep in mind, although there are mandates and penalties, the penalties are rather weak, and there's a lot of doubt as to how much effectiveness those mandate penalties will have in terms of ensuring that type of compliance with coverage, either employers offering coverage or individuals taking it up. It's a relatively small amount compared to the total cost of the premiums. I think that you are referring to the small business tax credit for companies that are basically under 25. That has had a minuscule take-up in practice because there are a lot of extra details as to which companies actually qualify for that. So whatever was projected, and that's a perishable incentive for a few years, has had almost a tiny amount of take-up. I think in all likelihood, most employers, particularly the larger ones or mid-sized ones, aren't going to suddenly drop their coverage in the first year. But if they see that the exchanges operate and there's some degree of a possibility of coverage that's sustainable, then you could have a large change in the projections as to which employers will continue to offer coverage under a lot tighter set of rules where they're saying we're writing these checks, but we don't actually control our own employer insurance plan.
Mr. Miller mentioned that this is part of this bill has already been rolled out. Some of it's already in effect. Why is it being rolled out in stages, Dr. Brandon? Why didn't they just say, okay, on such and such a date, it's all in the game?
Yeah, which is what we did with Medicare, a brand new program in 1 year in 1965. They got it all started, partly because this is so complex. Presumably, there were political calculations that we want to put it into the next term. And certainly, there were concerns about the cost accounting. So many of the expenses were put in the future, so it didn't count.
During the political campaign, a lot of people said, keep your government hands off my Medicare. And it's a government program. How much more complex, Mr. Miller, is this program? And how much more likely is it to have less success than Medicare, which is obviously popular among older Americans? How much of a problem will this be over what we've experienced with Medicare, which evidently is little or nothing?
Sure. Well, Medicare has changed a lot over its history of more than 45, 47 years. But when it first rolled out in the mid-1960s, it essentially attached itself to the predominant model of the time. Unfortunately, we haven't changed it a lot since then, which was the old standard Blue Cross Blue Shield plans. And so it wasn't a massive change. It was just a federal funding for what ultimately still remained insurance that was similar to what we were having at the time. And a lot of the intermediaries in handling this insurance ended up being other insurance companies in order to pass the bills back and forth, although the costs went a little bit out of control. This is doing a lot more in this law. You know, the soft sell says, well, we're just going to give you a little bit of money and you're going to get coverage and isn't that wonderful? Well, there's a bigger agenda here at work. Sometimes not everything could be pulled off politically in the time or under the laws that kind of barely got through Congress, so a lot of loose ends were left behind. But this is a massive, complex change throughout the entire healthcare system with a lot of ambitions to basically run the healthcare system from Washington while keeping the states as a little bit of a face-saving cover version of it.
We have to take a break. Thomas Miller is resident fellow of the American Enterprise Institute and author of Why Obamacare is Wrong for America. We'll find out why he thinks that's so in a moment. And Dr. William Brandon, Metro Atlanta Medical Foundation Professor of Public Policy on Health at UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina's Complete Care for Women, offering comprehensive women's health care from a belly button incisional outpatient hysterectomy to doctor-supervised midwifery services in a private practice setting. More at cccforwomen.com. Well, America has certainly made progress with race. We've gone from overt racism to the kind that's so hidden that we often don't realize that we've acted or spoken in a racist way. And that means there's still work to be done. Tim Wise is an anti-race activist who writes and lectures about his thoughts on the topic from the perspective of a white man. And he joins us with others to explore some of our racial blind spots tomorrow at 9.
On the next I and Reem show, more Americans have been forced to rent instead of buy a home in recent years, but prices are rising as demand outstrips supply. The pros and cons of renting in today's economy.
Join the Diane Reem show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act that is being gradually rolled out around the country and will be this year and next, and how the states are handling it, including North Carolina, and what to expect in the coming months and years with Dr. William Brandon, Metrolina Medical Foundation Professor of Public Policy on Health at UNC Charlotte, and Thomas Miller, Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Miller, in the last segment, said several times, I think, that this Affordable Care Act is really a part of a large agenda to put control of health care in the hands of the federal government. Do you see it that way too?
I do not. The way we've organized healthcare in the U.S. is that the federal government has the ability to regulate insurance. But it really does not control the healthcare system. Just as the federal government does
but,
not.
But will it under this new plan?
And it won't under this new plan. Now, you can argue that it's really important to control our increasing healthcare costs. 17.9% of our total wealth this past year went to support healthcare. And we're seeing these costs go up further and further. They've been for the last 30, 40 years.
And what does this do to control those costs?
And this bill has just about every idea for controlling healthcare costs, including it. So one of my concerns in talking to businessmen is saying it's Katie bar the door if this thing goes down. There really aren't any other viable ways to control healthcare costs. So we really better hope this works. Now, one more aspect. If it controls, it regulates insurance. It controls the finance side. It does not tell doctors what to do. And there are various things in the bill to nudge the healthcare system evolution along, something so-called accountable care organizations, which are integrated delivery systems that places like Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic have shown to provide quality care at cost and cost-effective care, so the prices actually are less than some comparable institutions. The patient's face for this accountable care organization is a so-called patient-centered medical home. So everybody needs to get signed up for a primary care. But the federal government can't control what people do. It just nudges it along. So it might be more successful if it were a takeover, but it is definitely not a takeover of the delivery of care.
We have done over the course of the last several years a lot of programs on the cost of medical care and debating this bill before it became law, et cetera. And almost every medical professional that I've talked to on and off the air, almost every hospital administrator that I've talked to on or off the air, almost every insurance professional I've talked to on or off the air has said that providing universal health coverage, or insurance rather, is a good thing for the country and for them, and they wish that this had been universal. And I asked them, where were you in the debate? And they were all silent about that. Why then do you say, Mr. Miller, that this is wrong for America?
Well, let me count them anyways.
I know you will.
I'll try to put them into baskets and not get into the micro detail. I mean, you certainly talk about the economics of this law, whether or not in the manner it's set out, we can afford it both in terms of budgetary effects as well as our larger economy. There are legal issues, although some of them were resolved differently by the Supreme Court, but this was really jammed through in a very unusual manner. I'll say it at that. Politically, this is a law that overall, you can check your history of the public opinion readings, it was passed basically over the wishes of the American public. Now, at times it's been a majority opposed to the overall law, at times it's been a plurality, but that's held up over a long period of time. They pretty much stopped polling that way.
Yeah, but how much how much of that opposition was because of the political rhetoric that was going back and forth about it? And it seems that more people are in favor of it now because of some of the provisions that have already rolled out, which indicates they might even be more in favor of it when it's all completely in place. Because it unties insurance from employment. If you lose your job, you keep your insurance. And that's a good thing for many people, don't you think?
Well, you can look at what I usually use. I've got a recent paper which talks about when Obamacare fails, does the history of that polling. If you look at the average in the period of time, Real Clear Politics tends to do this, you'll find out that that doesn't hold up. There was a brief blip in, I think, July after the Supreme Court decision came down where there was a little bit of an upturn in support for the law, but that's since fallen back down. A lot of it was a visceral reaction to the individual mandate and the totality of what the law was doing. When you get people into thinking about the trade-offs and you ask the second and third question, well, you like this, but what about that? This is not politically supported. There's administrative questions. This is a massive, complex undertaking. It's outstripping the ability of our government institutions to actually pull this off.
Okay.
It's pretty much riding roughshod over the states to a large degree, and it doesn't solve the fundamental problems of improving the quality of health care and lowering its costs. What we're getting instead are these Band-Aid fixes, which tend to basically say, well, we'll just cut the reimbursement and hope that it works out and someone will be more innovative. A lot of these make-believe approaches haven't actually materialized in practice.
Wait a minute. First of all, one of the ways in which we're spending money is by the very large profits of some of the insurance companies. So, for starters, one of the requirements that is being passed on, a requirement not on the delivery of care but on insurance, is that in the individual exchanges, you must have at least 80% of medical benefits, 80% of premium paid for medical benefits. For employer insurance, it's got to be 85% of medical benefits. So right off, there are efforts. There are ways in which healthcare money is being saved without impairing quality.
I want to talk about these exchanges, but I want to first go back to something, Mr. Miller, that you just said about this rides roughshod over the states. What does that mean?
Well, this is all somewhat of a cosmetic measure. If you actually look at the regulations that are put out to amplify what's in the law, yes, the states are being induced to try to be junior partners or sorcerer's apprentices, as I would call them, where they get to be kind of the face of what these exchanges are. But the real authority, the decisions would actually be made, remain very much set in under the law and the regulations. So the states are there to be the heat shields, to take the blame when things mess up. To provide the infrastructure, the local face of what is still largely a nationally driven enterprise.
But doesn't this
the states have very little real authority.
Doesn't this have to be nationally driven? Isn't part of the problem with insurance today is that a person in North Carolina may be paying more for health care than perhaps somebody in Iowa, and we can't buy the Iowa Blue Cross Blue Shield plan because we are not allowed to. This spreads it out nationwide. Why should I pay more in North Carolina than somebody in Iowa or vice versa?
Two parts to that. First, some of that cost differential relates to the practice of medical care, and there's some problems in that front where different areas practice differently and are higher cost or lower cost. So it's not all entirely related to insurance. Secondly, there's a different solution to that, and I've argued for this for about 10 years and written about it, which is to have interstate competition in insurance regulation to get better versions of insurance where a state that does a better version, you can buy the insurance regulated by them in your state. Now, there's some limitations on how far that can go, but there are other approaches to that than having this massive federal law which tries to control everything and does very little.
Why not just have national regulation of insurance? This is an industry. It was only an act of Congress in, 1940-41 that said we're going to let insurance be regulated by the state. So at least for health care, let the feds do it. And by the way, I agree with you, Mr. Miller, that giving the states this responsibility, which is a function which resulted because the House had to adopt the Senate version of the bills, it's almost a political artifact, and it looks in retrospect like it was a great mistake. They should have had one national exchange, which is why maybe having the feds take over more and more of the states that opt out might be actually help for implementation.
Well, Mr. Miller, in an article you wrote in December of last year, at that time, 32 of the 50 states, a majority, were not on board with running their own exchanges. Does that mean they want to give it to the federal government to run?
Well, they're saying, you know, a pox on all houses and not ours. I mean, there's mixed incentives there. There are a few states that actually, I think, have some creative, thoughtful ideas as to how they would like to run state exchanges. The Utah folks come to mind in that regard. They're a little bit an in-between state right now, but they don't want to necessarily do it the same way as what the federal regulations would require them to do. They have a different approach to exchanges. There's some other states where they're basically saying, we can't figure this out. The guidance is unclear. It'll cost us some money. What a headache. So let's go ahead and hope it fails in the federal hands and others. And there are others in between, somewhat keeping their powder dry, trying to figure out what's going on. The partnership is a very limited engagement. It's a fuzzy area as to how much states will do. So ultimately, we need, I think, states to assert themselves to say, here's how we'd like to do an alternative approach to delivering insurance coverage in compliance with the letter of the law, but there are better ways to do it than what the regulations have put out.
Could we ask about one state which is actually trying to be creative, and this is an argument against what I said before, letting states use their own intelligence, and that is Vermont, which is apparently on a path to introduce single payer, which, of course, is what the left has always wanted, but is not really viable on a national basis. So I wonder what Mr. Miller would respond about. Here's a state which is going to use this state authority, given some waivers from the feds, to actually try to do something really creative.
Yeah, I think they still have a little bit of problem on the ERISA side. I'm not sure if the waiver authority extends that far. But certainly, you know, if Vermont officials and the Vermont people wish to punish themselves, we can limit that mistake to one state rather than all 50.
A lot of states, and Mr. Miller has written about this, Dr. Brandon, he's written that dozens of state governors have complained about uncertainties, costs, complexities involved in implementing state-based health exchanges for the first time, and that the Obama administration held back more detailed and controversial regulatory guidance until after the election. If that's true, would you agree that this is complicated, even fraught with peril?
It is fraught with peril. And today's New York Times had an article that they're extending the deadlines for states to decide on partnerships.
And if it's fraught with peril, what is the worst that could happen?
Well, particularly in the North Carolina context, if McCrory chose to feels that he needs to sort of do something to show his basic opposition to the Affordable Care Act, I would be happier if he gave up on the exchanges and just said, let the feds do it. There will be exchanges. They'll be run by the federal government. There's obviously a learning curve, but it can be replicated in different states. And I think he really, at North Carolina, really needs to have the expanded Medicaid. I think that's the critical part. There will be so much federal money.
And that goes to poor people, correct?
And that's to poor people. It would be expanded up to 138% of poverty. But it would cover 54, according to the Kaiser national figures, it would cover 54% of currently uninsured people. So you're a long way towards the universal coverage.
Former Governor Perdue, requested that the state's health insurance exchange be a partnership between the federal government and the state. Now we have a new governor and a Republican majority legislature. How likely are they to maintain the arrangement? And the deadline for states to decide on whether or not they would set up state-based plans versus a federal one was November 16th of last year. Can they back out of this now? Can they change the plan, the agreement?
Mr. Miller is the lawyer. Okay. You were at Duke at the same time I was.
Hey, there's no reason to call anybody by names here.
So can they back out of it? Can they change the agreement?
is very open-ended. I mean, the governor in most states has the final call on this. There's a dispute in Mississippi whether the insurance commissioner can do this. I think what Governor Perdue did was she allowed the opportunity for McCrory to make the decision. They didn't have the ability to go to a state exchange because they never passed enough of the law in the previous legislative session.
You have a quote that I want to put onto the air because I love this, what you said here. You said that the real goal of the Affordable Care Act's version of state insurance exchanges is to construct a roach motel of centralized regulation where private plans and their enrollees might check in but are not allowed to check out. Explain that.
I'll stand by that. The reason why we don't have a complete federal takeover of health care in the Affordable Care Act was there wasn't enough time, there wasn't enough political support to do it openly. So you have to kind of get your foot in the door and build a set of walls over time. So the insurers who can comply with these rules that squeeze them down over time are going to be very much junior partners of what is largely a government-controlled enterprise, but they have to provide that private face to the public. So we'll have fewer and fewer insurers. Those who remain are those who are very much politically controlled, and they'll, you know, maintain a small margin in order to stay in business, but they know who their customers are. It's the folks in Washington, not their insurance customers in the state.
Do you see that coming? Do you agree with that?
I see no basis either in precedence or in law for this happening. Look at Medicare. Medicare is pretty much universal coverage for those over 65. And as far as I can see, you don't really see the takeover of insurance companies in that respect.
But if you have to supply coverage to everybody, even those and it's already happened, with pre-existing conditions, some of which can be horrifically expensive, can you stay in business as an insurance company? Is there enough in terms of spreading out the premium revenues to pay for everybody who's desperately ill, who heretofore could not get coverage?
And that's the great advantage, one of the great advances that are brought about by the exchanges. All the insurance, both for small businesses and for individuals, will be community rated, which means that with some modifications allowing for age and family composition, but not the healthcare status of the person, people will pay the same. That is, everybody in the same plan would pay the same. Maybe we should take a minute to talk about what exchanges do.
Yeah, I was going to get to that right now because you'll be shopping what from Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, whoever else sells health insurance. Is that what you'll do in these exchanges and pick the plan that's right for you and affordable for you? Is that what you're doing?
You will, but
why would the costs be different?
Well, because this is the conservative idea of market competition. So the idea is that you would have enough comparability in the policies. What we have now is people, one, don't choose. Their employer chooses for them. And the plans are so different. So you would have to –
Well,
in a
you
way,
know, I've done this before myself because I have a small business. And every year I've had to compare plans from four or five different vendors. And they're all pretty much the same right down to the penny.
Oh, they are? Good.
Right down to the penny. There is no choice is what I'm telling you.
Yeah, including the price.
That's what I'm saying, right down to the penny. What you get if you want this kind of coverage, it costs this, and it doesn't matter where you go to get it right now.
Yeah.
It's been my experience. Mr. Miller, you want to chime in on this?
Well, it can vary to some degree. Look, the ambitions of what you sometimes euphemistically call managed competition through the exchanges is if you make insurance even more of a commodity with configurations of coverage, they have these precious metal tiers, you know, silver, bronze, platinum, and gold. I like to look for zirconium myself, which is a little bit lower amount. All of this is – it depends upon how the exchange is implemented, but the idea is in some states that are more aggressive about this, they will try to literally regulate the rates very tightly. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you deal with that situation when you've got exploding costs? Well, you do one of two things. Either the premiums go through the roof, as they will for young people in a lot of these individual exchange markets, or you end up hollowing out the coverage. What you promised before turns out what you don't deliver because you still have to make ends meet even if you bring the rates down.
But the part of the act is that there is an essential benefit. Presumably that will cover most of what people need.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk more about exchanges and also about this expansion of Medicaid and whether or not we're ready for this, whether the states, whether the federal government, whether the healthcare insurance industry or the healthcare industry itself is ready for the influx of patients that will be suddenly streaming the doctor's office because they can afford it when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Goddard School, offering childhood preparation needed for social and academic success. Learning for fun, learning for life at the Goddard School, goddardschool.com. And The Machines Mums the Word, a surreal satirical portrait of 21st century America at the end of the world, now through Saturday at Spirit Square's Duke Energy Theater. Tickets at carolinatix.org. More Americans have been forced to rent instead of buying a home in recent years, but prices are rising as demand outstrips supply. So Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the pros and cons of renting in today's economy at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation about the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Isn't it funny how we don't like to be taken for granted, but we do like to be counted on? This is Michelle Norris from NPR News. Thank you. Thank you for your pledge during the recent drive and for proving you can be counted on to support public radio. Believe us when we say that we do not take you for granted. That's why we work every day to make sure the programs we broadcast serve you well. Thanks again.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Thomas Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Why Obamacare is Wrong for America. Dr. William Brandon, Metrolina Medical Foundation professor of public policy on health at UNC Charlotte, is in our studio. Mr. Miller is in Washington, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act and its impending implementation and how the states are handling it and what it means, good and bad, for America. Lots of people want to talk about this. Let me open the phones and talk and let some people join our conversation. We'll begin with Tony, who's calling us from Stanley. Welcome.
Hi. One of your guests talked about the 80% threshold that insurance companies will have to meet, thereby limiting their profits. First of all, it's not the duty of the federal government to limit the profits of a corporation, but they will no longer fight to keep health care costs down because they want to make that 80% threshold. They're going to make their pie bigger to make their profits go up. That cost, healthcare costs, will go up, not down.
And the answer to that is, if the exchanges are successful in promoting competition, they will lose market share to their competitors. Now, there are problems, in my view, there are problems with state-based exchanges. The number of people who will actually be in those exchanges will be relatively small, so I'm not sure how feasible it is to have real competition.
But isn't he right that maybe the cost of an individual procedure won't go up, but the amount of money we're putting out for healthcare is bound to go up? Because if you have insurance, doctors recommend a plethora of tests because the insurance will pay for it. If you don't have insurance, they generally don't recommend them because they know you can't afford it. Well, now you'll be able to afford it. So won't we be spending more money on healthcare because of these tests?
This is where you really need to look at the whole act. There are various efforts such as bundling, various changes in the reimbursement to discourage people doing extra unnecessary tests. So there are cost control measures that need to
But who makes that decision? Who, unnecessary tests. Who makes that decision?
The physician and the hospital, if you're hospitalized. And these are particularly related to chronically ill people in very expensive kind of conditions. We're actually going to spend more for preventive care.
But you don't want to be a doctor who's being sued because somebody died because you didn't perform a test because you thought it was unnecessary when it turned out to be. So wouldn't you be more likely to perform the test?
Well, certainly, if it's the standard of care, you're going to perform it. If it's not the standard of care, maybe the doctors will get more courage to say no.
So given all the scenario that I laid out here, Mr. Miller, do you think the overall expenditures on health care will go up?
Sure. What you're doing is you're stimulating demand, and the supply to keep up with it is going to lag behind. We've already got a shortage of primary care doctors and access to physicians looking ahead for an aging population. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have more people asking for these services with less of it being able to be provided. The caller was asking, alluding to the minimum medical loss ratios and the requirements. First, this has been overstated. There are not particularly large profits. You can find a few examples, but in general, you go in a 3 to 5% range for the profitability of insurance. insurers. What you're really squeezing out is the additional services that might be provided an insurer. And to the extent that they can't reduce those to a further minimum, you might want to increase the denominator, which is your total health care costs and premiums, in order to make that margin. There was a little bit of a rebate over the last year, but it wasn't particularly significant. That happens mostly in the individual market. It really didn't have much of an impact in the smaller business market or among larger employers.
Tony,
and just to follow up on that, the most recent national health care accounts, the 2011 accounts, have come out this month in Health Affairs, and the average medical benefits, non-medical benefits out of the premium was just over 12%. So the insurance companies are now meeting that requirement.
Tony, thank you for your call. Let's go to David in Black Mountain. Welcome.
Thank you so much. My question has to do with how in a state where we have a new governor and both houses of the legislature, which are absolutely unconditionally hostile to anything that the federal government might want to bring our way, we're possibly going to make the state health exchange work for North Carolina when they're going to throw everything in the way of it they can.
Who wants to take that? Is that possible? Will states who are opposed to this, Republican-controlled states, do what they can to sabotage it?
Well, they can certainly slow it down and not be cooperative. Now, there's an end run, which is the federal exchange, which may be done through these multi-state plans, which are regulated by the Office of Personnel Management, which can parachute into the state as the backbone for a number of states for the federally run exchanges. We haven't mentioned, though, there's also a lawsuit in Oklahoma challenging the legitimacy of providing premium assistance tax credits through federal exchanges because of the way the law was written with two different sections where they don't match up. If that lawsuit succeeds, it would pretty much disarm the threat of the federal exchanges saying to the states, well, if you don't run one, we're going to come in and run our exchange. And that would have a major consequence in terms of how much could be rolled out in these exchanges. Plus, the information backbone, the technology, the infrastructure, there's a lot of doubts as to whether that can actually be done on a nationwide basis through the federal exchanges in time.
You called Oklahoma's response to this possible lawsuit a surgical response, and probably the best way that states who are opposed to this have in slowing this down or putting an end to it. But how many states are likely to sue the federal government in this way?
Well, as a person who actually was recruiting some of those states, I know their degree of reluctance. I have some involvement in that Oklahoma litigation, though it's brought by the state attorney general. I think, as always, if one state succeeds, you have others coming on board later on. There's both the state of Oklahoma suing in that case, and then there's an employer group from Texas trying to intervene and join to bring the employer side of that challenge
rule. I know that the issues here are slightly different, but the Supreme Court has made this act legal. They call this a tax, and that's why the government has a right to do this, because the government has the right to tax. So in light of that, how likely is the success of any or all suits against this act by the states to the federal government, given the Supreme Court already saying it's legal? Get over it. Move on.
What provides is leverage for going back to the bargaining table. I don't think you're going to make the entire act disappear. I don't think you're going to end some type of subsidies, but they could be rewritten to operate in a different manner, which is much more consumer and state friendly.
Okay. Thank you, David, for your call. Tom in York County, welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning.
I'd just like to comment. It seems that this and every other conversation you hear on this subject is really more about politics and about health care for the public. And I really think that we'd all be better off if everybody sat down and tried to make it better rather than the Republicans trying to wreck it because Obama thought of it.
Well, actually, Obama didn't think of it.
It was a Republican idea.
It was a Republican idea.
Right.
A bad Republican idea.
It's vouchers.
Not really.
Vouchers are complex. In fact, conservative economist Mark Pauley at the Wharton School, going back to 2000, on the eve of the 2000 election, did simulations and showed that it would be very difficult to get the very lowest income people involved in vouchers, incredibly expensive, and the take-up rate for insurance would be very low. That's in a way, the brilliance why you have to look at this act as a balanced act. The Medicaid expansion takes care of the people who are the lowest income, who've been used to getting charity care, who are least likely to actually spring for their share of buying insurance. So it's really a three-level approach. One is expanded Medicaid. Two, for low-income, mainly low-income people and small businesses, the exchanges. And then third, for larger employment groups where we've in the habit of getting the insurance. Thank and Medicaid, of course,
Tom,
for the fourth.
Tom, thanks for your call. Let me go to John, who's somewhere between Charlotte and Gastonia. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Mike. Picking up on the last caller's question and with the answer of Medicaid expansion, if you look at all the studies that have been done for the last 30 years, looking at European countries, developed countries, and our country, they deliver higher quality health care at lower cost per citizen, and they have generally a single-payer approach. So as a general citizen, and I love all the policy wonk minutia today, but the real issue is how can we deliver the best quality care for the lowest possible price? And if you look at all these other countries, it's their kind of approach. With a single payer, you still have private delivered health care, you still have private clinics, you have private hospitals, but you have one single payer. Now, free market works great for toilet paper and automobiles, but for health care and the dire consequences, 45,000 deaths on average in the last several years have resulted from people who put off health care, then go to an emergency room, and they end up dying in the emergency room bed. So to me, it's a simple answer to a very human rights type of question, and I'll leave that and let you two folks go at it.
Okay. I asked a question several years ago on this program when we were talking about the very beginnings of national health care and what it would be like. Whether health care should be considered a right, a human right, or whether it's just something that you can get if you can afford it. And the more conservative people on the panel said, if you can afford it, you get it. It's free market. The liberal people said it's right. Does this panel divide that way? I mean, Mr. Miller, you're the conservative on this panel, and you're the academic. I'm not going to pigeonhole you. But Mr. Miller is a conservative. Should this be a human right?
It's not a right in the Constitution, and rights also impose additional obligations. If you say everyone has a right, the question is what are the boundaries of that right, and then what are you going to impose on other individuals in order to serve that right? So you're going to conscript doctors to treat people regardless because they have an unlimited right to health care. Look, we can get into that as a philosophical nostrum. I think that most of us support the idea of providing financial assistance to people who need help. That's usually on the basis of income, and that's on the basis of elevated health risk. We can subsidize and support those people who need help. We can't subsidize and support everyone. That's kind of what the country's been doing. That's why we have the deficits we do. So we need to be a little bit more streamlined in this approach with what's called a defined contribution, where we help those who need assistance and let the market operate in many other areas more effectively.
I want to talk about this expansion of Medicaid. Thomas Miller has written this book called Why Obamacare is Wrong for America. And Dr. Brandon, you have written a paper called Medicaid Transformed, Why ACA, the Affordable Care Act opponents, should keep expanded Medicaid. Why should opponents want to keep it?
Exactly in response, and part of my answer would be in response to Mr. Miller's point, with which I totally agree, which is that we all want to make sure that financial access to health care is not the impediment that can people get from getting needed care. As I mentioned earlier, 54% of the currently uninsured would be covered by Medicaid if the expansion went through and was adopted by every state. Moreover, Medicaid is actually a very efficient way to deliver care. People are looking at it again in terms of the ability to control costs. One answer is they pay providers less, but part of the Affordable Care Act is that for a couple years, 2014 and 2015, the reimbursement rates for physicians will be the will in Medicaid need to be raised to the level of Medicare. So we do have a problem of fair coverage. And, of course, Medicaid, which is growing at a slower rate than either Medicare or private insurance, as shown by the last national health care accounts, it's growing more slowly now. It will increase if more people get the care.
Mr. Miller, do you agree with any of that?
Medicaid is a troubled program. It's already expanded beyond the capacity to serve what it currently has. It pays well below the cost of its services. As a result, you have fewer and fewer physicians willing to participate in the program. You have continuing problems of fraud throughout Medicaid. You have the promise of very generous benefits which can't be delivered. I think we need to reform the Medicaid program. There are approaches to provide states with more opportunities to do that and be accountable for what they do. But this approach simply blows up Medicaid on steroids without solving the problems.
And you have called this, Dr. Brandon, a breathtaking transformation of Medicaid. In what way is it breathtaking? Is that a good term or a bad term?
Oh, from my perspective, it's a good term. In my view, it's taken what's been a means-tested categorical program, which has been severed from welfare, which is where it got it started. There's an evolution of Medicaid. And what it's turned it into is a universal entitlement that is the analog of Medicare. Medicare, you have to be 65 to get in. Medicaid, which will remain means-tested, it's 138%.
From what the two of you understand about what's happening here in North Carolina right now with a new governor and a Republican legislature, how is North Carolina likely to proceed?
I wouldn't call that. Can I brag about North Carolina a little bit and
quickly
challenge Mr. Miller? North Carolina leads the nation in its Medicaid program with our continuing care of North Carolina. So we've actually organized physicians across the state to accept Medicaid patients. In North Carolina, the Medicaid reimbursement rates are pretty close to Medicare reimbursement rates. Under the leadership of Alan Dobson, a physician in Cabarrus County, North Carolina is the closest to achieving status toward like an accountable care organization. So North Carolina is different from other states.
So, Mr. Miller, you're politically connected. How do you think North Carolina will proceed?
I would have liked to have seen the hand being shown a little bit earlier by Governor McCrory. I think you've got a pretty strong sentiment in the state Senate, vigorously opposed. In the House, they're not quite as frothing at the mouth over the ACA. I think in the final analysis, it would make more sense to just basically turn it over to the feds while indicating, here's what we would do in North Carolina if we had a freer hand to suggest an alternative path. Let me get my North Carolina bona fides in, by the way. I won't brag about the state, but I did go to law school at Duke, and I spent several years in Charlotte working on WSOC radio. So
really?
I'm not an out-of-stater.
So you played country music?
No. I was sports director in the Davidson Wildcat basketball.
I was going to say, this is what it's come to. Thomas Miller.
A different sport.
Thomas Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, author of Why Obamacare is Wrong for America, and former sports director, WSOC Radio. Dr. William Brandon, Metrolina Medical Foundation professor of public policy on health at UNC Charlotte. Thank you both for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you.